don't look like a wreck. I try to decipher whether he's just being nice or flirting, and I can't quite tell. I can see why he's successful in the real estate business. He oozes charm.
Ready?
He adds.
I am.
I close the back gate, and we stroll down the beach together. He apologizes for getting home late.
A little excitement at Aunt Lou's today. Somehow, none of the cousins really want to confess the details. Jonah poked a cocoa puff up his nose. I had to stick around and help with the extraction.
Did you get it out? Is he okay? Trent grins.
Black pepper. The obstruction was cleared via compressed air from inside the nasal passages. In other words, he sneezed. Whether Aunt Lou gets a confession out of the cousins as to who's responsible remains to be determined. There are seven of them. All boys, and Jonah is the youngest by 3 years, so he learns life lessons the hard way.
Poor little guy. I can sympathize. Being the baby isn't easy. Our family is all girls, though, and that was bad enough. If you need to go get him...
Are you kidding? I'd have a mutiny on my hands if I did. He loves it there. Two of my mother's sisters and a cousin live on the same street, and my mom and dad are usually here part of the year, so the food and the action are constant, and there's always someone to play with. That was the biggest reason I moved here and bought the real estate office after Jonah's mother died. I needed to cut my working hours back to something reasonable, but I also wanted Jonah to have family around. I didn't want him to grow up in an apartment with just me.
Questions rush through my mind. Most of them seem far too personal. Where did you live before? I already know the answer. I researched him back when I was following the blackmail theory.
New York?
Given the khakis, polo shirt, casual boat shoes, and slight Texas accent, it's hard to picture him in the buttoned-up basic black of a New York professional.
Commercial real estate.
I feel an unexpected sort of kinship with Trent Turner. We're both adjusting to new surroundings, new lives. I envy his. Big change, huh? Do you like it here? There's a hint of something. A little regret.
It's a lot slower pace. But yes, it's good.
I'm sorry about your wife. I wonder at the details, but I'm not going to ask. What I thought might be flirtation on his part is probably just the kind of loneliness that would be natural only a few months after such a loss. I don't want to lead him on in any way. I'm wearing my engagement ring, but it's a princess-cut emerald, so people don't always realize it's not just decorative jewelry.
We weren't married.
I blush instantly, feeling like a ninny for making assumptions. These days, you never know. Oh, sorry. I mean... His smile puts me at ease.
It's okay. It's complicated, that's all. We were co-workers and friends. She and I crossed some lines we shouldn't have after her divorce. I suspected Jonah was mine, but Laura said he wasn't. She was moving upstate to give it a try with her ex-husband again. I left it alone. I didn't know the truth about Jonah until after her car wreck. Jonah had internal injuries, and he needed a liver donor. Her sister got in touch with me because they hoped I'd be a match. I was, and that was that.
Oh, is all I can come up with. He catches my gaze. We stop walking before turning onto the path toward his house, and I know the rest of the story is coming.
Jonah has two half-brothers he almost doesn't remember anymore. It doesn't look like he'll get the chance to know them unless they decide to reconnect as adults. After the custody hearing, their father wouldn't let them have anything to do with Jonah, or me. That's not the way I want it, but that's the way it is. I understand the people my granddad helped better than you might think.
I can see why you would. I'm surprised by his openness.
The depth of his pain and disappointment are obvious. He doesn't even try to conceal the fact that he's conflicted about his decisions, or that a past error in judgment resulted in a situation filled with difficult choices. Those realities will affect Jonah for the rest of his life. I come from a world where we would never openly admit to such things, certainly not to someone who's practically a stranger. In the world I know, a polished exterior and an unblemished reputation are paramount. Trent makes me wonder if I've become too accustomed to the constraints that go with upholding public appearances. What would I do if I faced a situation like his? Jonah seems like a really great kid, I say.
He is that. I can't imagine any other kind of life now. I guess every parent feels that way.
I'm sure. He waits for me to start along the path, then follows. A spiderweb catches me in the face when we enter the yard, and then a second one. Now I remember why my cousins and I always fought about who'd be first on the trails when we rode horses in Hitchcock Woods back home. I pick off the silk and grab a dried-up palm frond to swish the air ahead. Trent chuckles.
You're not as urban as you look.
I told you I grew up in horse barns.
I didn't really believe you. I thought Granddaddy's workshop might scare you away when you saw it.
Not a chance. When I glance over my shoulder, he's grinning. Were you hoping it would? The path opens into the yard, and he sobers as we cross to the small, low-roofed cabin and climb the steps.
I'm not sure. I wish my granddad were here to make these decisions for himself.
Concern draws deep lines over his tanned forehead as he fishes the keys from his pocket and bends to look at them. I understand. I really do. I've wondered more than once if I should be digging around in my grandmother's past, but I can't help myself. I feel like the truth matters more. He slips the key into the deadbolt and opens the lock.
Spoken more like a reporter than a politician. You'd better watch out, Avery Stafford. That kind of idealism will come back to bite you in the political world.
I bristle at that. Spoken like someone who's dealt with the wrong kind of politicians. He's not saying anything that Leslie hasn't said to me already. She's afraid I'm too highbrow and not realistic about what a Senate run could mean. She forgets that all my life I've had to listen to random strangers offering their opinions about everything from our clothes to the tuition costs of the private schools we attended. Actually, not just strangers, but friends. In my family, public service is still public service. His face is impassive, so I can't tell whether he agrees with me or not.
Then you won't like what you're about to find out in relation to the Tennessee Children's Home Society. It's not a pretty story, any way you look at it.
Why?
The place was incredibly well-respected, and the woman who ran it, Georgia Tan, operated in powerful circles, socially and politically. She was well thought of publicly. People admired what she was doing. She changed the general perception that orphans were damaged goods. But the reality is that the Tennessee Children's Home Society in Memphis was rotten to the core. It's no wonder Granddad never wanted to talk about what he did in this little building. The stories are sad, and they're gruesome, and there are literally thousands of them. Kids were brokered. Georgia Tan made money by charging huge fees for adoptions, transportation, delivery out of state. She took children from poor families and sold them to celebrities and people with political influence. She had law enforcement agencies and family court judges in her pocket. She duped women in hospital maternity wards into signing surrender papers while they were still under sedation. She told people their babies had died when they hadn't.
He pulls a folded piece of paper from his back pocket and hands it to me.
There's quite a bit more than that. I printed this off today between appointments.
The paper is a printed scan of an old newspaper story. The title pulls no punches. It reads,
Adoption matron may have been most prolific serial killer.
Trent stops with his hand on the doorknob. He's waiting for me to look over the article.
Nobody ever came out here but my grandfather, and occasionally, clients. Not even my grandmother. But she didn't share his interest in the topic either. I told you that she felt that the past should have been left in the past. Maybe she was right. My grandfather must have felt that way in the end, too. He told me to clean this place out and destroy whatever was still here. Just be warned before we go in. I have no idea what's on the other side of this door.
I understand. But I was a federal prosecutor in Maryland. Not much shocks me.
Yet just the title of the article is shocking. I can tell that Trent's not letting me through the door until I've read the story. Until I've been warned.
He wants me to understand that what lies inside won't be warm and fuzzy stories about lonely orphans finally finding homes. I turn back to the article and begin scanning the text. Once heralded as the mother of modern adoption and consulted by the likes of Eleanor Roosevelt in efforts to reform adoption policies in the United States, Georgia Tan did, indeed, facilitate the adoptions of thousands of children from the 1920s through 1950. She also guided a network that, under her watch, allowed or intentionally caused the deaths of as many as 500 children and infants. Many of the children weren't orphans, said Mary Sykes, who, along with an infant sister, was stolen from the porch of her unmarried mother's home at only 4 years old and placed in the care of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. Many had loving parents who wanted to raise them. The children were often literally kidnapped in broad daylight, and no matter how birth parents tried to fight in court, they were not allowed to win. Mrs. Sykes would live for 3 years in a large white house operated by Georgia Tan and her network of helpers. Mary's infant sister, just 6 months old when a woman claiming to be a social services nurse took them from the family's porch, would live in the TCHS facility for only 2 months. The babies weren't given proper food or medical care, said Mrs. Sykes. I remember sitting on the floor in a room full of cribs, reaching through the bars and just patting my sister's arm. She was too weak and dehydrated to even cry. No one would help her. Once it was clear that she was too far gone to recover, a worker put her in a cardboard box and carried her away. I never saw her again. I heard later that if babies got too sick or cried too much, they'd set them in the sun in a carriage and leave them. I have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren now. I can't imagine how anyone could do those things to kids, but it happened. We were tied to beds and chairs. We were beaten, held under the bathwater. We were molested. It was a house of horrors. Over the course of 3 decades, children under the care of TCHS are reported to have disappeared en masse, their paperwork often vanishing along with them, leaving no record of their lives. If biological family members came looking for information or petitioned the courts, they were simply told that the children had been adopted and the records were sealed. Operating under the protection of Boss Crump, Memphis's notorious political kingpin, Georgia Tan's network was seemingly untouchable. The remainder of the article gives details about the brokering of children to wealthy parents and Hollywood celebrities, the grieving birth families left behind, the allegations of physical and sexual abuse. The last lines are a quote from a man who runs a website called The Lost Lambs. The Memphis branch of the Tennessee Children's Home Society had scouts everywhere, at social services offices, at rural medical clinics, in poor neighborhoods and shack towns.
Babies were often given to social workers and officials who might stand in Tan's way. Adoptive parents were sometimes blackmailed for more money, threatened with having their adopted children taken from them. Georgia Tan cultivated the protection of Boss Crump and the family court system. Ultimately, she enjoyed the freedom to alter lives at her discretion. She played God and seemingly had no regrets. In the end, Georgia Tan died of cancer before she could be forced to answer charges. Powerful people wanted to see the case closed, and so it was.
This is... I paused to search for a word. I'm about to say incredible, but it isn't the right term. Appalling. It's hard to imagine that something like this could happen, and on such a large scale, for years.
TCHS wasn't forced to close until 1950.
Clearly, Trent shares my mix of horror, astonishment, and rage. Mary Sykes's story of touching her dying sister makes me think of my nieces and nephews and the bonds they have with their siblings. Courtney used to climb into the triplets' cribs and fall asleep with them if she heard them crying at night. I just can't. I can't imagine. I've prosecuted abuse cases and corruption cases, but this is so large scale. Dozens and dozens of people must have known what was happening. How could everyone have just ignored this? It dawns on me then. I have family from Tennessee. They were political, influential. They held various state, judicial, and federal offices. Were they aware of this? Did they turn a blind eye to it? Was that the reason Grandma Judy involved herself with Trent Turner Sr.? Was she trying to right the family wrongs? Maybe she didn't want it to come out that her family had cooperated with these monstrous acts. Perhaps even supported them? The blood drains from my head, and I reach out to steady myself on the wall. My cheeks feel cold despite the warmth of the summer day. Trent's face offers concern as he stands poised to open the door.
You're sure?
He doesn't look any more certain than I am. We're like two kids trying to dare ourselves into forbidden territory. Is he hoping I'll change my mind and spare both of us whatever details await? The truth always comes out sooner or later. I'm of the belief that you're better off knowing about it first. But even as I say it, I wonder. My entire life, I've been so certain that we were above reproach, that our family was an open book. Maybe that was naive of me. What if, all these years, I've been wrong? Trent looks down at his shoes, kicks a loose shell off the porch decking. It bounces against a red toy tractor that looks particularly poignant at this moment.
I'm afraid what I'm going to find out in here is that my grandfather's adoption was something like the ones in that article where it mentions giving kids to government officials to keep them quiet. My granddad's adoptive father was a Memphis police sergeant. They weren't the kind of people who would have had a bunch of money to fund an expensive adoption.
He trails off as if he doesn't want to put any more words to the story, but in his eyes there's a mirror of my own fear. Do we carry the guilt from the sins of past generations? If so, can we bear the weight of that burden? Trent opens the door, and perhaps the mystery. Inside, the cottage is low-roofed and shadow-filled. The white plank walls are crackled and faded, and window glass hangs crooked in the wooden frames. The air smells of dust and mildew and something else that takes a moment to register. Pipe tobacco. The odor instantly reminds me of my Grandpa Stafford.
His office at the Lanyap house always held this scent, and still does. Trent flips on the light, and the bulb flickers stubbornly in a deco-era fixture that is out of step with the rest of the place. We move into the tiny one-room structure. It contains a large desk that looks as if it could have been bought at a library sale, two file cabinets, a small wooden table, and a couple odd chairs. An old black rotary phone still sits on the desktop. There's a canister of wooden pencils, a stapler, a three-hole punch, an ashtray that hasn't been cleaned, a gooseneck desk lamp, an electric typewriter in faded olive green. Shelves along the back wall sag under their load of stacked file folders, aging binders, loose papers, magazines, and books. Trent sighs, running a hand through his hair. He seems too big for this small space. His head is only about 6 inches from the rafters, which I see now are hand-hewn with notches in them, most likely salvaged shipwreck timbers.
"Are you okay?" I ask.
He shakes his head, then shrugs, indicating a hat, a vintage umbrella with a dragon carved into the handle, and a pair of blue boat shoes. All three wait by the coat hooks, seemingly in hopes of their owner returning.
"It feels like he's here, you know. He smelled like this place most of the time."
Trent opens the blinds, illuminating the bulletin boards that line the walls.
"Look," I whisper, dust catching in my throat.
There are literally dozens of photos, some bearing the bold colors of modern photography, some in the washed-out hues of old Polaroids, some in shades of black and gray with white frames around the edges bearing dates. July 1941, December 1936, April 1952. Trent and I stand side by side, staring at the wall, each lost in our own thoughts, awed and horrified at once. I take in images, children's faces juxtaposed with adult faces. The resemblances are evident. These are mothers and fathers and kids, presumably birth families who were separated from one another. The children's pictures now hang next to more recent photos of the adults they became. I look into the eyes of a beautiful woman, her smile vibrant, her hip jutting out as she rests a baby on it. An oversized dress and an apron hang loose on her frame, making her seem like a child playing dress-up. She couldn't be more than 15 or 16.
"What could you tell me?" I wonder. "What happened to you?"
Beside me, Trent thumbs a few of the photos. There are even more underneath them. Images layered over images. Trent Sr. was thorough in his work.
"There's nothing on the backs," Trent observes. "I guess that's why you didn't worry about asking me to take care of these. You wouldn't be able to tell who they were unless you knew already."
Sadness tinges my thoughts, but it's a vague feeling. My attention is focused on a photo of four women standing arm in arm on a beach. Even though the picture is black and white, I imagine the bright colors of their 60s-era sundresses and broad-brimmed hats. I can see the golden glint of sunlight on their long, blonde curls. One of the women is my grandmother. She's holding her hat in place. The dragonfly bracelet dangles from her wrist. The other three women bear a resemblance to my grandmother. Same blonde curls, same pale eyes, probably blue. They could easily be relatives, yet I don't recognize any of them. Each wears a dragonfly bracelet that matches my grandmother's. In the background, just out of focus, little boys squat by the tide line, their knees poking upward as they labor over buckets and sand towers. Is one of them my father? I reach for the photo, and Trent stretches up to take it down for me. When he pulls the thumbtack, something small and white falls, drifting like a kite losing the wind. It's familiar even before I bend to pick it up. A larger version of it rests in a pearlescent frame in May Crandall's nursing home room. A voice disturbs the air, but I'm so focused I almost don't realize I'm the one who's speaking. I've seen this photo before.
Chapter 18. Rill. The house is black as pitch inside. There's no lights left burning, and the curtains block the moon outside the bedroom windows. Around me, kids rustle in their beds and whimper and grind their teeth in their sleep. After all that time trapped in the basement by myself, it's a comfort to be with anybody. But truth is, this is no safe place. These girls tell tales. They say Riggs comes at night sometimes and gets whoever he wants. Mostly the little kids he can carry easy. I'm too big to carry, I hope. But I don't want to find out. Quiet as a shadow, I slide from under my blanket and tiptoe across the floor. I already walked it real careful before getting into my new bed tonight. I know where the squeaky boards are. I know how many steps it is to the door, how many to the stairs. The safest way past the parlor room off the kitchen, where the workers will be dozing off in their chairs. James told me all about going downstairs to the kitchen at night to steal Mrs. Murphy's tea cakes. I know just how he got away with it. But all the things James had figured out didn't save him in the end. So I need to be careful about sneaking out to tell Silas I'm waiting here for Fern to get back. Soon she does. I'll grab her up and we'll slip off in the dark. And Silas will take us home to the river. And all the terrible times will finally be over. What if Briny and Queenie don't want me back after what I've done? Maybe they'll hate me as much as I hate myself. Maybe they'll look at the skinny, sad girl I am now and see someone nobody wants. I shush my mind, because your mind can ruin you if you let it. I have to pay attention, to do everything right so I don't get caught. It's not as hard as I thought it would be. I'm down the back stairs in no time. A small circle of light seeps from the room off the kitchen. Someone snoring loud inside. Near the door, a pair of feet in heavy white shoes is flopped outward like moth wings. I don't even look to see whose they are. I just slip around the wall by the stove, staying in the shadow like James talked about. My toes test each new floorboard real careful. The ragged hem of my nightgown catches on the oven's rough iron surface. I imagine it making noise, but really it doesn't. The screen door in the washroom squeaks a little when I tug it open. I stop, hold my breath, stretch my ears toward the house. Listen. There's nothing. Soft as a whisper, I go on out. The porch boards are wet with dew, just like the deck of the Arcadia. Overhead, katydids and crickets give the sky a heartbeat, and a million stars shine like far-off campfires. The half-moon hangs heavy, rocking on its back. Its twin rides the ripples in the rain barrel as I pass. All of a sudden, I'm home again. I'm wrapped in the blanket of night and stars. The blanket is part of me, and I am part of it. No one can touch me. No one can tell one of us from the other. Bullfrogs croak, and dark birds call as I run across the yard. The thin white gown skimming my legs, light as milkweed silk. Near the back fence, I cling close to the holly bushes, give a whippoorwill's call. An echo answers. I smile and breathe in the sweet, heavy smell of jasmine and hurry toward the sound, pushing my way along the big boys' tunnel until I'm there at the fence. Silas is on the other side. In the moon shadows, I can't see his face, only the outline of his applejack hat and his knobby legs bent up like a frog's. He reaches through the bars for me. Let's go, he whispers, then locks onto one of the bars like he means to pull it loose with his bare hands. I cut this one most of the way through. It oughta. Grabbing his hand, I stop him. If he opens the hole, the big boys will see it in the morning when they come to their hideout. I can't. Everything inside me screams, go, run. I can't leave yet. Fern's coming back. The people who took her don't want her anymore. I have to wait till tomorrow night so I can bring her with me. You gotta get away now. I'll come back here for Fern. Doubts start through my mind, skittering this way and that. No. Once they know I'm gone, once they see the hole in the fence, we'll never get her out of here. I can sneak away again tomorrow night. And there's another little boy, Stevie. He's from the river, too. I can't just leave him here. How am I going to manage it? I know where Stevie sleeps, but getting him from the toddler room and bringing Fern and not letting anyone see us? It doesn't seem possible. Even so, Silas being here makes me sure of myself. It makes me brave. I feel like I can do anything. I'll find a way. I can't leave Fern or Stevie here. They belong to the river. They belong to us. Mrs. Murphy and Miss Tan stole enough from me already. I want it back. I want to be real Foss again. Before this is over, I'll find all my sisters and my baby brother and bring them home to the Arcadia. That's what I'll do. Silas reaches out, and his long, thin arms circle me. I lean toward him, and his cap tumbles off. His forehead rests against my cheek, his raven's wing hair tickling my face. I don't want you to go back in there. He slides a hand over my hair, soft and careful. My heart speeds up. It's all I can do not to bust through the fence right now. It's only one more day. I'll be here tomorrow night, Silas promises. He kisses me on the cheek. Something new shivers through me, and I close my eyes hard against the feeling. Leaving him there is as hard as anything I ever did in my life. As I crawl off, he packs mud on the bars so nobody'll see the fresh cuts in the metal. If one of the big boys happens to lean against the fence while they're in their tunnel, I hope it doesn't break. I'm back to the house and up the stairs without even breathing again, it feels like. At the top, I check the hall and listen for sounds before starting around the railing where we line up for our baths. There's nothing but moon shadows from the stairway window and sleep noises. One of the little kids talks in his dreams. I freeze, but then he goes quiet just as quick. Only 15 more steps, and I'll be back in my room again. I've made it. Nobody will know where I went. Tomorrow, it'll be even easier now that I've done it once. James was right. It's not that tough to get away with things here if you're smart. I can fool all of them. The idea swells inside me. It makes me feel like I took something from them. Something they stole that was mine. Power. I've got power now. When we're safe on the Arcadia, the river carrying us far away from here, I'll forget all about this place. I'll never tell anybody what happened here. It'll be like it never happened at all. A bad dream with bad people in it. I'm so caught in the idea. I step wrong. A floorboard creaks under my foot. I hold back a gasp, look down, then decide the best thing I can do is hurry on in case one of the workers shows up. If I'm in the bed, they won't have any way to know who was. I almost don't see Mr. Riggs till I'm right on top of him. He's coming out of the toddler room. He stumbles back, and so do I. His shoulder hits the wall, and he whispers, "Oof!" I turn to rush off, but he grabs me by a fistful of nightgown and hair. His big hand clamps over my mouth and nose. I smell sweat, and whiskey, tobacco, and coal ash. He bends my head back so far, I think, he'll snap my neck right here. He'll snap my neck and drop me down the stairs and say I fell. That's how it ends. I strain my eyes to see him. He looks around, tries to decide where he can take me. I can't let him get me to the basement. If he does, I'm dead. I know it. Fern will come back tomorrow, and I won't be here. Checking the stairs, he wobbles on his feet. His boot comes down hard over my toe, and stars shoot across my eyes, and I moan. He clamps his hand harder, cutting off my air. I hear my backbone crack. I twist and push and try to get free, but he only crushes me tighter against him, lifting me off my feet and dragging me down the hall into the shadows by the bathroom door. His fingers fumble for the handle to open it. I whimper and struggle and pull until finally he growls low in his throat and pins me to the wall so he can get at the door. His belly crushes my chest, and blackness circles around my eyes, and my lungs choke for air. His face comes close to my ear. You and me can be friends. I can get you peppermints and cookies. Anything you want. We can be best friends. He rubs his cheek along my chin and my shoulder, his whiskers scrubbing hard as he smells my hair, then sticks his face in around the neck of my nightie. You smell like outside. You been meeting one of the big boys down there? You got a boyfriend again? His voice seems like it's coming from far off, echoing the way foghorns do on the river's cold mornings. My knees buckle. My feet go prickly and numb. I can't feel the wall or him. My ribs jerk like a fish's gills when it's hanging on the stringer. I see sparkle fairies. They dance wild in the dark. No, I tell myself. No. But there's nothing left to fight with. My body's gone. Maybe I'll suffocate and die. I hope so. Just as quick, he lets loose of me, and cool rushes in where his body was, and a breath pours into my belly. I slide down the wall and land in a pile, dizzy, blinking, and trying to push off the floor. Mr. Riggs! The sharp voice of a worker comes from the stairway. What are you doing up here at this hour? My eyes clear, and I see him standing in front of me so she won't see. I pull back into the shadows, squeeze tight against the wall. If they catch me here, I'll be the one who's in trouble, not him. I'll get locked away again. Or worse. Heard thunder while ago. Gotta close up the windows. The worker comes around the railing. The moonlight catches her, and I see she's the new one that came since Miss Dodd left. I don't know much about her, or if she's mean or not. She sounds mean. She doesn't like Riggs being up here, that's clear enough. If she gives him trouble, she won't last long at Mrs. Murphy's. I didn't hear anything. She twists back and forth, looking toward the bedroom doors. Outside when I heard it was some stray cats yowling. Took my rifle out to kill him. Good heavens! You'd have woken the whole place! Surely the cats aren't hurting anything. Cousin Ida don't like nothing prowling round where it don't belong. By Cousin Ida, he means Mrs. Murphy. He also means to let the new worker know her place. I'll check the windows myself. She's not backing down. And I don't know whether I'm glad or not. If she keeps coming closer, she'll see me. If she leaves, Riggs will drag me off into the bathroom. No need in disturbing your sleep, Mr. Riggs, when I'm being paid to watch the children at night. He moves away from me and closer to her. His steps uneven and wobbly. At the corner of the railing, he blocks her path. The two shadows melt into one. He whispers something.
Mr. Riggs!
Her hand swings out of the shadow and back in. Skin slaps on skin.
Have you been drinking?
I've seen how you been watching me.
I have done no such thing.
You be nice, or I'll tell Cousin Ida. She don't like nobody to give me trouble.
She sidles to the wall and slides past him, and he lets her by.
You will keep away from me, or I'll tell her myself. I'll tell her you got liquored up and were fresh with me.
He lumbers on toward the stairs.
You ought to look. See the little boys first. Somebody's tumped out of bed in there.
His feet fall heavy as he walks on down. The boards squeak and sing. Hugging her arms around herself, the worker watches him before going to see about the toddlers. I stand up on shaky legs and hurry to my bed and pull the covers all the way to my neck and wrap up. It's a good thing, because the worker comes in our room next, maybe thinking Riggs was closest to it. She walks along and lifts covers and looks at every one of us like she's checking for something. When she comes to my bed, I breathe long and deep and fight hard not to shiver as she pulls the covers off me and feels my skin. Maybe she wonders why I'm wrapped up so tight when it's sticky hot. Maybe she can smell the night on me like Riggs did. She stays over my bed a while. Finally, she's gone. And I lay there looking up at the dark. One more day, I tell myself. You only gotta get by one more day. I think it over and over again, like a promise. I have to. Otherwise, I'd find a way to get that screen off the window, and I'd jump out and hope it's high enough to kill me. I can't live like this. I fall asleep, knowing it's true. Morning comes in fits and jerks. I wake and sleep, waiting on the voices of the workers to tell us to get out of our beds and put on our clothes. I know better than to move before that. Mrs. Pulnick made sure to tell me the upstairs rules before she showed me my bed and the little crate underneath where I keep my clothes. But I won't be needing that crate for long. I'll get us out tonight. All three of us. Me and Fern and Stevie. No matter what it takes. If I gotta grab a kitchen knife and stab it into somebody to get us past, I'll do it, I tell myself. I won't let anyone stop me. It's not till we're downstairs for breakfast that I know I've been making promises that'll be hard to keep. First rattle out the box this morning, Mrs. Pulnick spotted sandy footprints in the kitchen. They're dried, so she knows they were put there last night. They fade out before the stairs, which means she can't tell where the trail would end up. But the prints are big enough that she's sure it was one of the older boys. She's got them lined up, and she's trying them one by one against the tracks to see who fits. She hasn't noticed yet that I've got big feet. Standing by my place at the table with the rest of the girls, I squeeze my toes in and hope she won't look my way. Maybe one of the boys is the size of the prince, I think. And I know that's wrong, because I'd be getting somebody in trouble. Bad trouble. Mrs. Murphy's in the room, too, and she's hotter than a jar fresh out of the canning pot. She's got an umbrella with all the cloth torn off. She means to whip somebody with it. After that, it'll probably be the closet. I can't get the closet. But can I stand by and let it happen to somebody else when it's my fault? It'd be the same as if I was swinging the umbrella myself. Through the washroom, I see Riggs by the back screen door. He's watching the show. He nods and smiles at me, and my skin goes cold. The new worker looks on from the corner, her dark eyes skittering. She's never seen anything like this.
It could have been me, she babbles out. Mr. Riggs mentioned stray cats outside, and I went to shoo them away.
Mrs. Murphy barely even hears her.
You will not interfere, she screeches. And your feet are too small. Who are you covering up for? Who? No one.
Her eyes dart off toward me. Mrs. Murphy and Mrs. Pulnick try to follow them. Time slows down.
Be still.
Be still, I think. Don't move. I stay frozen.
Could be those who was there last evening. That there's mud round the rain barrel.
Riggs tosses in, now that everyone's looking at my side of the table. At first, I think Riggs wants to help. And then I understand. He just doesn't want me locked up tonight, where he can't get at me. Mrs. Murphy bats a hand at him.
You hush. Honestly, you're far too kind to these little ingrates. Give them an inch, and they'll take a mile.
She slaps the umbrella against her palm, studying my side of the table.
Now, if it wasn't one of the boys, then who could it be?
The girl who was in the bed across from me last night, Dora, tips her head back and wobbles around and faints dead away on the floor. Nobody moves.
Not her, I guess,
Mrs. Murphy says.
And if not her, then who?
The umbrella swings in a circle like a magic wand.
Step away from the table, girls.
Her eyes sparkle.
Let's see who our little Cinderella might be.
The phone rings, and everybody jumps. Then we stand still as statues, even the workers, while Mrs. Murphy decides whether or not to answer. When she does, she half-yanks the phone off the wall. But her voice goes honey-sweet, soon as she knows who it is.
Why, yes! Good morning, Georgia! How delightful to hear from you so early!
She pauses and then says,
Yes, yes! Oh, why, certainly! I've been up for hours. Let me walk back to my office and pick up your call in private.
The words echoing through the phone come fast, like the rat-a-tat-tat of the Gatling guns in cowboy western movies.
Oh, I see. Of course.
Mrs. Murphy sets down the umbrella and lays a palm on her forehead, her lips pulling back from her teeth in a way that makes me think of Queenie the last night I saw her.
Well, yes, we can accomplish it by 10, but I don't think it's advisable. You see,
more talk comes through the phone, loud and fast.
Yes, I understand. We won't be late.
Mrs. Murphy says past her teeth, and when she slams the earpiece back into its holder, she points my way with her eyes narrow and her mouth squeezed into a tight ball.
Take her and clean her up and put her in a Sunday dress. Something blue to match her eyes, and with a pinafore. Miss Tan wants her downtown at the hotel by 10.
Mrs. Pulnick's face looks like Mrs. Murphy's. The last thing they want to do with me right now is wash me up, brush my hair, and get me in a dress.
But she... Do not question me!
Mrs. Murphy howls, then swats Danny Boy in the head hard, because he's the one closest. Everybody shrinks away as she sweeps a finger around the room.
What are all of you looking at?
The kids don't know whether to sit down or stay where they are. They wait until Mrs. Murphy pounds through the swinging door. Then they slink into their chairs while the hinges are still creaking.
I will be taking care of you myself.
Mrs. Pulnick grabs me by the arm, squeezing hard. I know she's about to get revenge on me one way or the other. But I also know that whatever Miss Tan has planned, it could be even worse. There are stories about what happens to kids when the workers take them to hotels.
And don't leave any bruises on her!
Mrs. Murphy's order echoes in from the hall. Just like that, I'm saved. But then again, I'm not. Mrs. Pulnick yanks my hair and wrenches me around. She tries hard to make the next hour hurt as much as possible. And it does. By the time I'm finally walked out to the car to join Mrs. Murphy, my head is pounding, and my eyes are red from the tears I've been told I better not cry. Mrs. Murphy doesn't say a word in the car, and I'm glad. I just press myself close to the door and look out the glass, scared and worried and sore. I don't know what's about to happen to me, but I know it won't be good. Nothing here is good. On the way downtown, we pass by the river. I see tugs and barges and a big showboat. Its calliope music pushes into the car, and I remember how Gabian used to dance on the deck of the Arcadia when the showboats went by. He'd make us laugh and laugh. My heart strains toward the water, hoping to see the Arcadia, or old Zeed's boat, or any shanty boat at all. But there's nothing. Across the way, a river camp sits empty. There's only dead fire pits, trampled circles of grass, and a stack of drift somebody gathered up but never burned. The shanty boats are all gone. It hits me for the first time that it must be about October by now. Pretty soon the maples and the gum trees will change. Bits of red and yellow edging along their leaves. The river gypsies have already started the long, slow drift south, down to where the winters are warm and the water's chock full of fat catfish. Briny's still here, I tell myself. But all of a sudden, I feel like I'll never see him, or Fern, or anybody I love ever again. The feeling swallows me whole, and all I can do is let my mind leave my body. I'm not there when the driver parks the car in front of a tall building. I barely hear Mrs. Murphy threatening what'll happen to me if I don't behave. It hardly even hurts when she pinches through my dress and twists the skin over my ribs and tells me I better do whatever I'm asked to do in here, and I'm not to tell anyone no, or cry, or carry on about it. You'll be as sweet as a little kitten. She squeezes my skin harder and holds her face close to mine. Or you'll be sorry. And so will your little friend Stevie. You wouldn't want anything to happen to him, would you? She gets out on the curb and drags me with her. Around us, men pass by in business suits. Women stroll along with bright packages. A mama in a red coat pushes a baby carriage out of the hotel and glances at us as she goes by. She has the kindest face, and I want to run to her. I want to grab onto her coat and tell her everything. Help me, I'll say. But I can't let myself. I know they'll take it out on Stevie if I do. And probably Fern, too, once they get her back to Mrs. Murphy's house. No matter what, I have to be good today. I have to do everything they say, so they won't lock me up when we get home tonight. I straighten my back and tell myself this is the last time. This is the last time they'll ever be able to make me do anything. Whatever it is, I'll go along. But my heart flutters, and my stomach tightens like a fist. A man in a uniform holds open the door. He looks like a soldier or a prince. I want him to rescue me the way the princes do in fairy books.
Good day.
Mrs. Murphy smiles and raises her nose and marches on. Inside the hotel, people are laughing and talking and having lunch at a restaurant. It's a pretty place, like a castle. But it doesn't seem pretty today. It seems like a trap. The elevator man stands like a statue by the buttons. It doesn't even seem like he breathes, while the little box takes us up and up and up. When we get off, the man sends a sad look my way. Does he know where they're taking me? What's about to happen? Mrs. Murphy walks me down the hallway and knocks on a door.
Come in,
a woman calls. And when we do, Miss Tan is sprawled out on a sofa like a cat resting in the sun. Behind her, the curtains are open, and a big window shows the whole city of Memphis. We're so far up, we look down on the roofs. I've never been this high in the air in my life. I squeeze my hands into fists and hide them in the ruffled pinafore and try not to move. Miss Tan's got a half-full glass in her hand. She looks like she's been here a while. Maybe she lives in the hotel? She swirls the brown drink, lifts it toward a door across from the sofa.
Put her in the bedroom, and then that will be all, Mrs. Murphy. Close the door as you leave her, and instruct her to sit quietly until she's told otherwise. I'll speak with him out here first, to make certain our arrangement is in order. I don't mind staying, Georgia. If you'd rather.
She watches me as we cross to the door, Mrs. Murphy holding me up under the armpit, so I can't help but walk uneven.
Honestly, there would be better choices, but I can see why he wants her, Miss Tan says. I don't know why anyone would want her.
Inside the bedroom, Mrs. Murphy sits me on the bed and fluffs the frilly dress around me, so I look like a pillow doll. She yanks my hair forward over my shoulders, letting it hang in long curls, and then tells me not to move an inch.
Not one, she finishes when she's heading out the door.
She closes it behind her. I hear her and Miss Tan talking in the other room. They chat about the view and share a drink. Then there's nothing but quiet, and the faraway sounds of the city. Horns honk. A streetcar rings its bell. A newspaper boy yells. I don't know how much time goes by before there's a knock at the front door. Miss Tan answers, sticky sweet, and I hear a man's voice, but I can't make out the words until they come closer.
Of course. She's all yours. If you're certain you still want her, that is,
Miss Tan says.
Yes, and I appreciate you altering our arrangements on such short notice. My wife has struggled terribly these last few years, often to the point of taking to her bed for weeks on end, locking herself away from me. What else can I do? Indeed, I can see where the girl might serve your needs, but I do have other children who are more tractable, Miss Tan suggests. We have many older girls. Yours for the asking.
Please, I think. Pick somebody else. And then I know that's wrong. I shouldn't wish bad things on the other kids.
No, I wanted her specifically.
I squeeze the bed covers. Sweat coats my palms and seeps into the fabric. I dig in my fingernails. Be good. Whatever it is, be good. Silas is coming tonight.
What else can I do? The man asks again. My wife is so very fragile. The child will not stop carrying on. I cannot have the constant upheaval and noise around the house. I am a composer, you know, and it interferes with my work. I've several scores for films due by the holiday season, and time is running short. Oh, sir, I can practically assure you that this girl will bring you more trouble, not less,
Mrs. Murphy pipes up.
I assumed you only wanted her for... I had no idea you planned to take her with you permanently, or I would have spoken up sooner. It is of no matter, Mrs. Murphy, Miss Tan snaps. The girl is certainly old enough to be compliant with whatever Mr. Sevier should desire. Yes, yes, of course, Georgia. Pardon my interruption. The girl is perfect in every way, I can assure you, sir. Unblemished.
The man says something I can't make out.
and then Miss Tan talks again.
Very well, then. I have her documents for you,